I'm talking about first some conceptual perspectives. What convictions do people in recovery share? And I'd like us to, at least for this segment, to think of recovery in the broadest possible way. That I'm not thinking just about people working 12-step programs. I'm thinking about people recovering from addiction, abuse, or trauma. And when you look at that huge range of issues, are there any really common themes that, like, everybody seems to buy into? Common themes. And I think there are. I think there's a lot of common ground. Let me talk about a few. Some basic recovery convictions. The first is that there is a problem. That seems simple enough. And you would think that that would be a no-brainer, particularly in the Christian community. We've always had the doctrine of sin. Sin is a problem. And so to say there's a problem, you would not think would generate a lot of resistance. Unfortunately, we have a variety of ways. While our formal theology might include a doctrine of sin, our practical theology might look quite different. Our lived theology might look quite different. I remember as a child having a sense of abstraction about the doctrine of sin. It did have something to do with very distant relatives who had done something bad. I wasn't quite sure what they'd done. It had to do with apples. But that God was so angry at them that somehow it affected all of us. And I couldn't quite explain why that was so. I mean, these were really distant relatives. I knew they were distant relatives because they didn't come to Grandpa's house on Christmas, right? And, you know, if they weren't coming to Grandpa's house on Christmas, they were hardly part of the family. So these were just, you know, really distant relatives. And somehow we were in a mess because of those guys. There was kind of an abstraction to that. That didn't have much to do with me. And then later, when I sort of had a better grasp of what people might mean when they were talking about sin in that context, I also had a sense that, yeah, sin was a problem, but, you know, it's really a problem that's been completely solved. Really. What God has done for us in the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Jesus has completely solved the problem with sin. So it was sort of an abstract problem, sort of a theoretical problem. For a kid, now think somebody 12 years old thinking, it was kind of a theoretical problem that had been theoretically solved. So I wasn't sure that there was a problem anymore. In fact, for most of my life, well, if you'd asked me for my formal convictions, sin would have played a prominent part. I probably would not have been able to tell you any particular sin that I was focusing on and trying to do anything about. Okay, it wouldn't have been, there's a problem that's really a problem. It would have been a problem I could have talked about, I could have given lectures about, I could have explained in various ways, I could have given a little talk about, you know, seven ways the Bible talks about sin, but I'm not sure that I really could have told you that it was really a problem. You know, it was pretty theoretical, pretty abstract. It wasn't sort of embedded in my ordinary life. It was a lot of neck up to it, you know. And I think this was reinforced in the Christian traditions in which I spent most of my early years with an alternative view. Probably the first thing I learned about the Christian life as a young child was that every day with Jesus was sweeter than the day before. How many of you sang this as children? Anybody sang this little song? Ah, I'm so sorry. At least somebody's as sick as I am. there was a in the Christian community, not infrequently, a kind of adaptation of the American spirit of optimism. Americans are one of the most optimistic cultures in the history of the planet, I think. And if you get that instinct baptized with Christian sentimentality and Christian language, you get this very optimistic view that really, there is, I mean, if every day is sweeter than the day before, there really isn't much of a problem. If, we had lots of songs about this, if all the burdens of your heart have been rolled away, are there problems left? No, all your burdens have been rolled away. If you have joy, joy, joy down in your heart, we had a whole hymn book full of this kind of stuff that was so optimistic, such an optimistic construal of what life was supposed to be like, that there wasn't much room for problems. So theoretically there was a problem, but Jesus had completely solved that. And practically, it was just happy all the time. Now that sort of spiritual environment, in that kind of spiritual environment, it's very difficult to stay practically connected to the notion that there is a problem. This problem, this becomes even more, I think, a practical problem for people preparing for professional roles in the Christian community, because in most Christian communities, we expect our leaders to be really, really good and to be happy all the time. We want you to be really good. We want your problems to be pretty theoretical problems. We don't want your sin to be kind of a practical thing that you have to be dealing with on a daily basis. That scares us. Okay, so there's a seductiveness to the call to ministry in our culture, I think. Part of the deal is an invitation to be an admirable person. A person is good enough that everyone would admire. We don't tend, when we're interviewing people for jobs in churches, or I noticed in seminaries, ask people what sins are the ones that are most pressing on you. What are your struggles? What are the ways in which you notice in your life that there is a problem? We don't usually ask those kind of questions. We want to know how successful you have been in not having problem. Okay? And as a result, I think we tend to wind up being very spiritually weak. There's not a robustness to that, because a lot of it is just pretending that there is no problem. I think even a casual reflection on the Christian doctrine of sin should make this a no-brainer. Sin is not something off there in a distance for us to discuss abstractly and theoretically. It is ready at hand. It is close to home. It is deeply embedded in our lives. And until we have a capacity to see that problem, that close to home, up close, deeply embedded kinds of problems, it's going to be very, very difficult for us to have any sort of practical experience of God's grace. Doctrine of sin is, I think, absolutely critical to understanding grace. Okay, questions about that? Yes, ma'am.
Did you say the doctrine of sin?
Yeah, the idea of sin, the conception of sin, the practical conception of sin. I mean, you can't have, it is possible to have a doctrine of sin, as I've emphasized, that's just sort of abstract and theoretical and has nothing to do with my real life. And I think that is just a form of denial. I think that's a way to avoid what's real. And as we'll see when we talk about what people do when they do recovery, paying attention to the way sin actually affects my life is an important dynamic in the recovery process. So that's why it's important for us to have access to the fact that there's a problem. If there's no problem, why recover? I mean, you do not need to recover if there's no problem. That's pretty, that's a no-brainer. Maybe I spent enough time on that, but this took me about 15 years. So it takes a long time to set in. If there's no problem, you do not need to be in recovery. If you're well, you don't need a physician. It's a no-brainer. Yeah.
How does this balance with people who are actually aware of their addiction, have a heavy sense of
Yeah. Well, you, as a tactic, piling shame on top of people who are already aware, are already carrying a lifetime's supply is rarely of positive effect. I mean, I just don't think that's a strategy that I've seen to be helpful. I've not experienced that to be a helpful strategy in my life. I've never seen it help anybody else to increase their level of shame when they already have some access. Now, if someone's a sociopath, has no access to them being a problem, it may feel, when you're telling the truth, like you're increasing their shame. They may tell you that you're increasing my shame, but all you're doing is telling the truth. And that's how I'd focus on it. Focusing on telling the truth is one thing. That someone experiences that as increasing their shame is part of their defensive structure, trying to keep you quiet from saying all this awful stuff that you're saying. If you're just telling the truth, then you're just telling the truth. We'll come back to this as an issue. Let me go on to the next piece, which is equally difficult, but I think a shared conviction of people in a wide range of different kinds of recovery journeys, and that is the problem is my problem. I don't mean by this that all problems are my problem. I don't mean that my problems are worse than everybody else's problems. It's just that recovery is going to involve change, and the change which constitutes recovery is change in me. I can't fix my problem by having my wife change. I can't solve my problem by having my kids change. I can't solve my problem by having my parents change, my colleagues change, my students change. I can't fix my stuff by trying to get other people change. The change that constitutes recovery is change in me. That means that of all the things that I'm focusing on, I need to pick those things that are mine. And there's a lot of ways in which internally we resist this. If, for example, I experience anger, I always experience that initially as the anger you caused me. I'll say, you made me angry. Who's the subject of the sentence? You are. Who did something? You did. Who owns this little drama? You do. I'm sort of the passive object of the sentence. You made me angry. Okay? So it's a kind of disownment initially to lots of negative emotional experience. Negative emotional experiences are painful, and one of the ways in which we protect ourselves from that emotional pain is we disown it. Say, I'm not angry. You made me angry. This is about you. It's not about me. Well, if you made me angry, there's nothing there for me to recover from. Okay? It's not till I own part of this problem as my problem that there's something that I can work on. I mean, if you made me angry, maybe you need to recover, but there's nothing there for me to recover from. I don't think. It wouldn't be a recovery strategy. Okay? And I think this is a difficult pill to swallow. When we talk about in the addiction context, this is the source of lots of denial. We have 50 reasons why the problem is not my problem. I once had a woman come into my office and ask me to officiate at her wedding. Both she and her fiancé were active alcoholics. And I said, no. And I said, you know, I am willing to do something for you. We can go downstairs, get in my car, and I'll drive you to a treatment center where you could get some help. Can you think of reasons why we shouldn't do that? Because if you did that, you might have a chance at having a marriage that works. If I were just to say yes to officiate your wedding, the odds of this marriage being successful are zero. But here's a pathway that might have a chance of leading you to a successful relationship. Why shouldn't we do that? And then I shut up. And I listened for 45 minutes, And I just wrote down all the reasons she had for why this problem was not her problem, which is this was her list. This problem is not my problem. It was because of her parents, because of her fiance, because of culture, because of metaphysics. It was, I think it was like 28 different reasons why it would not include things like, I really want to go to the Betty Ford Center, and they don't, I don't have enough money to go to the Betty Ford Center, and you know, it's just all kinds of reasons why the problem in that case was Betty Ford Center. They cost too much money. So the problem is not my problem. If they offered services at a reasonable cost, then I'd get help. So the addicts for sure have an enormous capacity for stumbling at this point. And that's why in 12-step programs, there's a very disciplined process, a structured process called taking inventory, which is a process of figuring out what of all this mess that I'm struggling with is the problems that are my problems. Because those are the only ones that I can work on. Questions about that part? This is true, let me emphasize, not just in the case of addictions, but let's take sort of a harder example for this particular point. Suppose you've been in an abusive relationship. Someone has abused you. There's lots of problems here. This person who abused you, they've got, you know, all the problems they can carry in life. There's obviously lots of problems there. But working on that person's problems is not about being in recovery. You have to find something that you can take ownership of. This is my problem. If it's not my problem, I can't really work on it. I'll never get traction on it. And I think we spend a tremendous amount of energy working on other people's problems. Now, certainly there's all kinds of reasons to get, there's a lot of hard work to be done, typically in the cases of abuse in particular, sorting out whose problem is whose. That's often a difficult and painstaking and long process because we will take inappropriate ownership of problems that are not our problems. But just let me use myself as an example. I already, in a previous segment, talked about my strategy for survival in my family as a child was to disappear, was to hide, to absent myself. And that didn't seem to me like a problem. That seemed to me like what saved my life. Okay. Later in life, when I'm in a relationship and it becomes a difficult patch in that relationship, a stressful period in that relationship, I'm using the same strategy. It doesn't work for me to say, this problem is my parents' problem, right? Doesn't give me, I mean, initially I'll look at those behaviors and I'll say, I know why I do this, and I'll lean into my resentments at my parents for their inabilities at being effective parents, and I'll be focused on that, wondering why they couldn't change, why they're still that way, all that kind of stuff. And it won't really be yet into the territory we call recovery. It won't be until I can take ownership of the fact that in spite of the fact that it was only the way I had to survive, I continue doing this behavior in relationships where it's not necessary. I withdraw when it's hurtful in the relationship and unhelpful in the relationship. I do that. I can own that. And I don't just do that because it was adaptive as a child. I do that because I think it will work now. And that's a problem. I have a problem. Yeah?
I have kind of a question. Psychology majors, be prepared to jump on me. To what extent do you think the psychological community, the psychologists and therapists, act almost as enablers because of what I perceive to be the amount of digging it, you know, where did this come from, my family, my parents, my abusive husband, as opposed to coming down to the fact that you have a problem and you can't change them, but you have to change yourself?
Yes, well, it's an interesting question, probably beyond the scope of what I'm going to talk about now. But the question has to do with does focusing on the past sometimes distract from our capacity to take ownership of my problem now as my problem? That certainly happens. I wouldn't lay the burden of that on the psychological community solely. I think you'll find lots and lots of pastors who will say to someone who's working on abuse issues, are you still working on that? Why are you focused on the past when you're a new person in Christ now? You should be just living today in the glorious victory of Jesus. Okay, so it's a bigger problem than just sort of the psychological one. And we will actually get back to this a little bit later. I think I want to move on here, though, and talk about some other basic convictions. Third thing is recovery takes time. Now, I may have beat this to death already in this class. I don't think anybody likes this about recovery. This is not a real marketable feature of the recovery process. It was the general truth is I always have had people ask me how long this is going to take. When I was serving as a pastor in a local church, I would lie to people. God help me. People would come in my office and we'd talk about stuff, and I'd say, well, maybe you could just go to therapy for a couple sessions just to see, you know, if there's anything there. I don't know. There might be stuff to work on, or maybe you could just go to, you know, our support group for alcoholics for a couple sessions and see, just to see whether your experience matches. And people would come back like 2 years later and say, you sucker punched me big time. You knew, which of course I did, that, you know, this was going to be 2 years, 4 years, 5 years. This is long, hard work. We have all of us been practicing being the way we are for a long time. We have. And most of us started practicing being the way we are very early. So it's deeply embedded stuff in us. Changing that stuff will not be easy, will not be quick. It will require us to lean into the grace of God to the point of terror. Grace is a terribly good thing. It's something that happens when you're terrified that it's not going to happen. That's most often when God will come in and say, there it is. You are ready to receive now. That's not a very marketable commodity, but that's what's real. That sin is not at the surface of our lives. It's deeply embedded in us. We live on a fallen planet. All of us are deeply impacted by sin. It's not an abstraction. It's a problem, and it's our problem. And dealing with it is going to take more than psyching up to commit at a deeper level, which is a transient kind of thing. All of us know what it's like to psych up, to be more committed, to make a commitment, to jump through a religious hoop. We've all done that and experienced the disappointment when it doesn't last as long as we hope it would last. Recovery always takes time. Okay, a fourth thing. Recovery takes place in relationships. This is sort of a horror list of horror stories, isn't it? I mean, this is all bad news, I think. There's a problem. It's my problem. It takes longer than I want. I know it's not obvious when someone stands up and talks every time we get together how much of an introvert I am, because my role is not the introvert role here. But I am a world-class introvert. I do not like that. It's not about liking. I am drained by being extrovert. And one of the things that terrified me most about the recovery process is that it takes place in relationships. I really, really wanted, you know, to buy all the best books about recovery and sit down in my den and get educated about recovery and get better by myself. Thank you very much. This was, I thought this was, you know, a strategy that was well adapted to me, because I am such an introvert. And I can testify that this is an utterly, there's no likelihood of success to that strategy. It does not work. All the stuff that we will find that's my problem, that's taking a lot of time, that's going to be stuff that we learned in relationships. We didn't learn that out, those problems out of books. You know, we didn't sort of read a book and all of a sudden be different. All that stuff was learned in relationships, often very early relationships, often over a long period of time. And trying out new behaviors is going to have to take place in healthier relationships. And that can be a variety of things. It can be a relationship with a therapist, with the pastor, with a sponsor, with a group, with some friends. There's lots of different places to try out new behaviors. But it unless it's happening there, it's not going to have the energy that it needs to really change us. It can't happen just by thinking about it. If you take an alcoholic and give them a world-class education about alcoholism, you get an educated alcoholic. Okay? That's all. You just get a really, really educated alcoholic. The sorts of problems that we're talking about this class, it's a true abuse as well. You take someone who's been abused and give them a PhD level education about abuse, and you get a person who's been abused that has a PhD level of education on abuse. These are kinds of problems that don't typically respond to education, to knowing more. Because knowing more doesn't necessarily affect our relationships. Yeah. Okay, that's a really good question, because you can become an addict in isolation. You can, I'm thinking of someone who was a religious professional who their pattern of abusing alcohol involved drinking themselves to sleep every night, which they did for 25 years. No one knew. Well, there were people who knew, but it wasn't obvious. It took them a while to get going the next morning, but it didn't hit the fan until they got a liver scan back. You know, it was something really wrong. So, and you might think that happens in isolation. I'd say it there were some reasons why the person was isolated that had to do with stuff that happened in relationships. You know, my instincts to withdraw in times of stress could have led to that kind of path. But that instinct to withdraw is a way of being in relationship. And it just looks like isolated, but it's withdrawing from something. Don't meet me to communicate that we develop these problems because we all start out as social drinkers. But the damage that leads to the problematic drinking, we'll talk about this more next time, always happens in a context that's very social. You start to tease apart what's going on there. It's not just people are isolating for reasons, and that has to do with the nature of the relationships that they're isolating from and the people they're isolating from. Yeah.
And you mentioned you don't have a sponsor. I don't know if you feel the same way on that. In other words, it's good to have a sponsor. It's good to have maybe an accountability partner, even pastors and such.
Right.
But I think as I look at just the richness of the community and being one to another, there's got to be a lot of different layers to really get to.
Right.
This is a bigger pile.
Yeah, this is a really actually very important issue, and I'm going to come at it from a little different angle later in another segment, but the point is that there isn't some sort of magic relationship that, oh, I got a sponsor, now I have some traction here. This is about looking at the whole network of relationships I have and, you know, developing realistic expectations about what sort of resource each of these different kinds of relationships can be. That is, I have a long history of having really unrealistic expectations about what can come from different kinds of relationships. And it took me a long time to realize it's okay to just get this little piece here. I can go here for just this. I'm not going to get all my needs met here in one place. This is not the whole package. It's just one piece of a bigger strategic plan for being a healthier person. That I'm going to have some people that are very close, that provide certain kinds of needs, other people that are a little, you know, this. When you talk about boundaries, this becomes a really key issue. Some people get past all my boundaries and I have very intimate relationships with them, but I don't want to have intimate relationships with everybody. I need relationships that are not intimate ones, right? I need sort of casual relationships. I need people that I can watch junk TV with. And that's the sort of level at which it works. That's fine. Go out to a junk movie with. I know you're all too spiritual to go to junk movies, but upon occasion, in a moment of great weakness. Okay. Let me see if I can't get through the rest of these before the break. Recovery is a spiritual journey. That is, in the end, the changes that constitute recovery are spiritual changes. If you take, I mean, this is sort of identifying where the problem is that's my problem. If in the case of an alcoholic, for example, you were to take away all access to alcohol, what would you get? You would get an alcoholic who has no access to alcohol. You might call him a dry drunk. You might call him, which is a very pejorative term, but okay, you might call him that. But you don't get a healthy person just by taking away the alcohol, because in the end, alcohol is not the problem. Okay? I mean, there's something very important there. If you have a person who's addicted to crack and you arrange things so they have no access to crack, you get a crack addict who has no access to crack. You don't get a sober person. You don't get a healthy person. You just get a person who's not does not have access to their drug of choice. That may be a much less likable person. It may, in fact, nothing is more common in recovery when people stop using, for other people close to them to start complaining about, you know, you used to be a lot easier to get along with when you were using, because the whole system has adapted to the insanity. And when one person starts to get better, everybody feels a threat. Okay? So it doesn't necessarily mean that things get better when people stop using, because stopping using is just the first step. I mean, it's just... it's not a small thing in a way. It's a huge. It's a miracle to not use. But the changes that constitute recovery are not just about not using. And in particular, just let me emphasize that. I think I've already mentioned this, but switching addictions is the way most people would prefer to recover. So. If people are ragging on me because I'm drinking too much, I can stop drinking and increase my use of marijuana quite easily, no problem, easy peasy. I'm not an alcoholic anymore. I'm just using marijuana a lot more than I want to, and it's causing the problems. Later on, people decide, you know, this isn't working. You really not. You need to stop smoking pot. I said, well, okay, I'm not going to smoke pot anymore. I'm taking too much heat from the family. They're ragging on me about that. So I act out sexually, or I get more engaged in my work because I love my work. No problem there, particularly if you're a pastor, because you work for God. Who can possibly complain about that? And you sort of try to find a focus for your addiction that generates the least hostility. That's not the same thing as being healthy or being sober. It's just, replacing one addictive substance or process with another addictive substance or process, not getting down to the spiritual changes that need to take place. Now, you would think that Christians in general would be excited about the fact that spirituality is a core, at the core of this. That doesn't always turn out to be the case, because the premise is that, spiritual journey is kind of a soft word. I thought about putting down recovery as a spiritual death march. Okay, sort of. It's just journey sounds like, I'll get a journal, and it might be. I'll go out and have coffee with my friends and talk about something I wrote in my journal, about my journey. And I don't think that most people experience the recovery process as being like that. It is an agonizing, hard journey that requires the support of other people. It requires discipline. It requires the grace of God to do it at all. Because it involves spiritual change, I think it will create often more anxiety for people who already have spiritual commitments than for people who don't. That is, if you have a pagan who's an alcoholic and they hit bottom and start getting help, and someone says it's a spiritual journey, they don't have... They're sort of starting from scratch. Whereas if you take, just at random, we'll take a nice evangelical Christian who's a student at an evangelical seminary, who's an addict, they're going to sense that spiritual change poses a threat. I got this right when I was 8. I went forward. I said the right things. I signed the back of the 4 spiritual laws. I've done everything I was supposed to do spiritually. And it makes me very anxious that someone's suggesting that there might be spiritual change necessary. Okay? This is in part because the normative spiritual narrative in the Christian community tends to be simple ones. We're supposed to get it right at the beginning and then just stay right. Okay, stuff like that we've already talked about. And so it's experienced as a threat that spiritual change might be involved. But that is the deal. And there will be a moment when it's unclear how much of the spiritual stuff I've got now needs to go. It just won't be obvious. There will be a stage of the process that involves tearing down existing spiritual structures, to use a building metaphor. There will be a sense of threat, where a moment when you don't know how much of this needs to go down to the foundation. Very early on in the recovery journeys, there's a sense this is not about redecorating. A new coat of paint is not going to fix what's needed here. Some of this has just got to go back down to foundations, and that feels terrifying. It feels like I've got a lot invested in the existing structure. But sometimes it has to go down all the way to the foundations. And sometimes you have to sledgehammer out the foundation, jackhammer out the foundation, and start with a new foundation, because it's all been built on sand. This is not a fun spiritual process. It's a difficult long-term process. The only good news I have to say for about this is that God has a long, long history, apparently, if we're to take the Bible seriously, of working with people doing exactly that. And does not seem to be intimidated by that, doesn't seem to be nearly as anxious as we are about that. When we get rid of our idolatrous attachments, we get very angry, and God apparently gets quite excited. He's not displeased, because we're actually doing, in spite of the terror, exactly the right thing. Okay, so the fact that recovery involves spiritual change is like opportunity and danger. I think that's how people experience that. I always like to close this by saying that recovery is possible, because by the time you go through the rest of this sort of common convictions about recovery, one wonders. I think that this is a really important emphasis. It's not possible because we're strong enough, good enough, anything enough to make it work. It's possible because God's committed to be working with us for as long as it takes. There are some of the problems that are my problems that are taking time that I'm convinced will take more than a lifetime. I think God's made it very clear that that's okay. God's prepared to work with us on stuff that takes more than a lifetime. He has mansions prepared. He has plans that are not just lifelong for us, but is willing to be engaged with us. It was really when I got to this point in my own journey that I had a renewed appreciation for eschatology. Okay, sort of very fundamentalist environments in which I was raised, eschatology was just about the timing and sequence of future events, something which the New Testament text, I believe, was almost completely unconcerned with. But when I really got the sense that I had stuff that needed more than a lifetime to fix, I was really interested to know whether God's sense about the kingdom lasted longer than a lifetime, whether God was prepared to stay committed to this process for as long as it takes. And I think that's one of the bottom lines of New Testament eschatology. God's hanging in for as long as it takes. There was a question.
I was wondering what you meant by more than a lifetime. Like generations? Like family stuff?
Yeah. Both of those points are good ones, in that I think that if I look at my family system, there's only so much that you can do in a generation. Both of my parents were raised by violent, abusive parents. They lived horror stories as children. They moved a little bit. I would rather have been raised by my parents than my grandparents. They were not remotely close to being the kinds of parents that little Dale Ryan needed to grow up in a healthy way. My generation, we passed on to our children our stuff before we knew we had stuff. And but we were dramatically healthier parents than my parents. It's hard to say this with my son here, but he's just such a better father than I was to him. So I do have a sense that grace can sometimes accumulate over multiple generations, that blessing can last from generation to generation, just as curses can last from generation to generation. And that's an important piece of the puzzle in terms of being motivated for recovery. I'm doing my recovery not just for me. It's not just about narcissistic self-making. It's not just an existential exercise in, you know, being a person. It is for my kids and for my grandkids and trying to keep the grace flowing. But it's that's not really, I think, an eschatological observation in the New Testament sense. I think for me it's really important that God has plans for us personally that go for more than a lifetime, that he has mansions prepared, and that whatever that means, this is God's commitment to us that go on as long as they need to go on. And, you know, if that turns out when we get to heaven that that's quick fix, magical, spectacular, all of a sudden Dale Ryan's as healthy as Dale Ryan could possibly be, that's fine with me. If it takes long, I don't know whether, because you got a lot of time. Once you start talking about heaven, you can imagine lots of time. If it takes, you know, it takes a long time there, that's okay too, because that's all going to be good news. It's all going to be headed the right direction. Okay, let's take a break. Oh, yeah, let's take 10.